Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA, LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to be here to introduce our show to you today, August 27th, 2005. Our theme for today is Confronting the War Makers, and here's what we have coming up. After the news, which will include a short broadcast from Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, we'll hear coverage from last night's peace vigil in Portsmouth, which featured an exhibit illustrating the human cost of war and supporting Cindy Sheehan's continued vigil in Crawford, Texas. In our first hour, we'll also hear an interview of Mary Lee Sargent from New Hampshire Peace Action about the campaign to get Senator Judd Gregg to hold a public meeting to discuss exit strategies from Iraq. The campaign included a civil disobedience action at the senator's Concord office on June 2nd. In our second hour, we'll talk with Tom Lee of New Hampshire about his new book, Battle Babble, Selling War in America. The book exposes the rhetoric of war through a series of expanded definitions of over 200 familiar terms, from American peace and area denial munitions to victory. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. First, for some news, with Steve Diamond, who has recently returned to us.
And now for some news. Our first story is from politicalaffairs.net. Republican congressman breaks ranks, joins demand for documents on the Downing Street memos. Congressman Jim Leach, Republican of Iowa, has informed Congresswoman Barbara Lee, Democrat of California, that he will be co-sponsoring her resolution of inquiry into Bush administration communications with the UK about Iraq at the time of the Downing Street memos. Leach is the first Republican member of Congress to publicly support a demand for an inquiry into the Bush administration's pre-war claims. The 131 Congress members who have signed Congressman John Conyers' letter to the President about the Downing Street memo are all Democrats. The 11 senators who have asked the Senate Intelligence Committee to do the investigation it committed to in February 2004, but never did, are all Democrats. The resolution, H. Res. 375, has been co-sponsored by 52 Democrats, including Lee. Leach is the first Republican to join them, and he is a member of the International Relations Committee. The International Relations Committee has 27 Republican members and 23 Democrats. Thus far, 10 of the Democrats have co-sponsored the resolution. If the other 13 vote for it as well, then along with Leach, one more Republican vote will be needed for a tie, or two more for passage. Leach has questioned Bush's war policies for years and was one of five Republicans in May to vote for Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey's amendment requiring an exit strategy. Another of those five, Congressman Ron Paul of Texas, also serves on the International Relations Committee. John Bonifaz, co-founder of the After Downing Street Coalition, said, "Congressman Leach has broken the silence of the Republican Party on the Downing Street minutes. His willingness to co-sponsor Congresswoman Barbara Lee's resolution of inquiry is bound to make the White House nervous. It is not possible for the president to paint this demand for documents as coming solely from his opponents. This is a demand for the truth. Did the president deliberately deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for going to war against Iraq? We as a people, from Crawford to Des Moines to Washington, D.C., regardless of our political persuasion, deserve to know the answer to that basic question." And from Reuters, library sues over controversial Patriot Act. A controversial Patriot Act clause allowing the U.S. government to demand information about library patrons' borrowing habits is being challenged in federal court for the first time by a library. The lawsuit was filed against U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and FBI Director Robert Mueller in the U.S. District Court for the District of Connecticut by an unnamed library and the American Civil Liberties Union. The suit, filed on August 9th and made public by the ACLU on Thursday, calls the FBI's order to produce library records, quote, "unconstitutional on its face," and said a gag order preventing public discussion of the lawsuit is an unlawful restraint on speech. Critical details of the lawsuit were blackened out on the ACLU's website in compliance with the gag order. The library is thought to be based in Connecticut since the lawsuit was filed there with the participation of the Connecticut branch of the ACLU. The ACLU said in its lawsuit that legal changes made under the Patriot Act, quote, "remove any requirement of individual suspicion," and the FBI may now demand sensitive information about innocent people. Enacted after the September 11, 2001 attacks, Patriot Act lets U.S. authorities seek approval from a special court to search personal records of terror suspects from bookstores, businesses, hospitals, and libraries in a provision known as the Library Clause. The FBI letter requesting the information, called a national security letter, is effectively a gag order because it tells the recipient that the request must be kept secret. As a result, the Patriot Act is itself gagging public debate about the Patriot Act, said Ann Beeson, the ACLU's lead lawyer in the case. The Civil Liberties Group has asked the district court to lift the gag order so its client can participate in the public debate and upcoming congressional hearings on the Patriot Act. A hearing about lifting the gag order is scheduled for Wednesday in Bridgeport, Connecticut. An FBI spokesman referred calls to the Department of Justice. A justice spokesman said the department had no comment and declined to say if it had requested libraries to turn over records under the Patriot Act. The U.S. House representatives, ignoring protests from civil liberties groups, voted this summer to reauthorize 16 provisions of the act that expire at the end of the year, including the Library Clause. The Senate is expected to take up the matter after lawmakers return from an August recess. A copy of the ACLU lawsuit said the library involved, quote, strictly guards the confidentiality and privacy of its library and internet records and believes it should not be forced to disclose such records without a showing of compelling need and approval by a judge. The FBI, in a copy of the letter demanding the library records and attached to the lawsuit, said, quote, the information sought is relevant to an authorized investigation to protect against international terrorism or clandestine intelligence activities.
To finish up our news today, here is a segment from Free Speech Radio News in Lebanon, talking with Palestinian refugees about the right of return.
As much as the world's focus has turned towards the Israeli withdrawal of illegal Jewish settlements on occupied Palestinian land in the Gaza Strip, hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, the majority of whom were displaced through the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, continue to demand their right to return to their villages, towns, and cities throughout Palestine. Mohammed Shablock and Stefan Christoph visited the Lebanese refugee camps and filed this report.
On the bustling streets of Lebanon's Palestinian refugee camps, Israeli withdrawal from Gaza delivers no concrete change. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon continue to struggle for survival in overcrowded and war-torn camps, while articulating a united call for their right of return. Khalud Hussein, a Palestinian refugee from Bosha Barashni camp, explains.
I think about this withdrawal, I'm not that optimistic about it because maybe it's a good step for the Palestinian inside Palestine, but not for us as a Palestinian here. Because with all these agreements, they just canceled us from their plans. They never talk about our right of return. All their agreements were between the Palestinians who established the Palestinian government, but we are not mentioned in these plans. So that's why I'm not optimistic about it.
Forbidden from owning property, working in over 70 professions, and legally defined as foreigners, Palestinians live in Lebanon without any basic social or political rights, as second-class citizens. Today, unemployment in certain camps reaches 80%, while it is commonly estimated that more than half of the refugee population lives in poverty. Today, Palestinians in the camps of Lebanon are demanding that the Lebanese government grant them full social and civil rights, while continuing to articulate their demand for a full right of return to Palestine. For Palestinians in the camps, these two issues are closely related. Wasim Mahmoud, a Palestinian doctor practicing in Bosha Barashni refugee camp on the outskirts of Beirut.
Not giving our civilian rights in Lebanon, weakening our infrasocial structure. Education, I tell you, is weak now. We have now much social problems. We have to strengthen ourselves. I don't mean by weapons only. Strengthening our social infrastructure to think how to deal with policies, how to struggle better in order to get our right to return back home.
Many Palestinians living in the camps of Lebanon view Israel as an illegitimate state. founded on wars which directly resulted in their dispossession. In the face of Israel's withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, Palestinians in the refugee camps of Lebanon continued to articulate the history of displacement which defines the Palestinian identity. Adil Al-Ali of the General Union of Palestinian Students in Lebanon.
We see the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza as a defeat for the Zionist project. The Zionist project is based on establishing a Zionist state on Palestinian land. Accordingly, when Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip, it's a defeat for the Zionist ideology. We do not say a defeat in the militant meaning. We say a conceptual and ideological defeat.
The withdrawal of illegal Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip has been applauded by the international community and governments throughout the world as a historic step towards a resolution of the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. While the demand for the right of return, voiced by Palestinians in the refugee camps of Lebanon, remains unanswered. This is Stefan Christoph with co-producer Mohammed Shublak, reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Beirut, Lebanon.
I was born a refugee, and I don't know if I'll ever see the old farmhouse I've heard about. But it's where I belong, there is no doubt, 'cause my whole family is from that farm. We never did nobody harm. And if you're confused by what you've heard, let me boil it down to a single word. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I have heard my grandpa say that on the street, most every day, the neighbor's kids would kick a ball with my dad when he was small. We were Christians, they were Jews, but it was no big deal. Religious views, so it was strange that at the point of a gun across the river, we had to run. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. We had Dipke, we had songs, and we all knew where we belonged. We grew crops, life was good there in the land where Jesus stood. Now we're scattered everywhere, but there's no peace anywhere. Now I'm just searching for some kind of sign, for some way back to Palestine. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home.
That was David Rovics with I Want to Go Home. Now we hear audio from last night's vigil in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. This vigil featured an exhibit called Eyes Wide Open New Hampshire, The Human Cost of War, which the New Hampshire American Friends Service Committee is bringing around the state over the next week in solidarity with Cindy Sheehan and Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. This is Amy Antonucci for Making Waves on WSCA. It's Friday night at the Portsmouth Vigil in Market Square, and tonight there's a special exhibit being held here as well as the vigil called Eyes Wide Open New Hampshire. And we're talking with Arnie Alpert from the New Hampshire American Friends Service Committee. We'd like to talk with him and find out a little more about the exhibit and its origins.
Hi, thanks, Amy. The exhibit that we have right here consists of 10 pairs of military-style boots. 8 of them are tagged with the names of soldiers from New Hampshire who have died in Iraq. 2 of them have no names associated with them right now. This is connected with AFSC's larger exhibit, which is called Eyes Wide Open, which currently consists of more than 1,800 pairs of boots, all tagged with names of soldiers from the United States who have died so far in this war. And we've brought it here to Portsmouth today as part of an effort to reinforce the message of Cindy Sheehan and the people at Camp Casey down in Crawford, Texas, who are trying to get some answers from the president, trying to get the president to meet with them, and trying to send the message that it is time to bring the troops home from Iraq and end the war and end the occupation.
Have you been doing this long in New Hampshire?
This is the first day of this exhibit. It just got started, and we'll be doing it through the 31st of August when the president's vacation is scheduled to end. He's supposed to be going back to Washington, and Cindy is going to disband Camp Casey and get on a bus herself and take a slower route to Washington, getting there in time for the large demonstration on September 24th, where she no doubt will be one of the major speakers.
And I understand you had a press conference this morning. How did that go?
Would have been better if there had been more press there, but we did have Channel 9 stop by and did an interview with Will Thomas from New Hampshire Veterans for Peace, and also Joe Turcott, who is an Iraq war vet who lives in Manchester and is a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. So we had a good conversation with them, as well as with some other people that came through the park while we were there.
Where else are you planning to bring it?
Well, this afternoon we were set up in front of the State House by the War Memorial at State House Plaza in Concord, where again we had good conversations with people who came through. Tomorrow we'll be at the Blues Festival with people from Seacoast Peace Response and New Hampshire Peace Action. Sunday, Veterans for Peace will take care of the exhibit in Manchester, where it will be displayed during the African Caribbean Festival in Veterans Park. We'll be back in Concord on Monday, and in Keene on Tuesday, where Mothers Uniting for Peace and the Monadnock Men's Resource Center will be placing it on exhibit at Central Square in Keene, right opposite Charlie Bass's congressional office.
What message are you particularly trying to promote or give to people in bringing this around? I know you spoke of Cindy Sheehan. Is there anything else that you're trying to bring to light?
The exhibit itself is pretty simple. It's just, this is radio, so you can't see it, but it's 10 pairs of black boots, and they're just right here lined up next to each other on top of a brick sidewalk with a sign in back of them that says, Eyes Wide Open, New Hampshire, the Human Cost of War. We want people to think about these 8 people who have died in Iraq. We want people to think about the other folks we don't know, folks whose names we don't know, who have died, about the thousands or countless numbers of Iraqis who have died, and to know that if we don't end this war and occupation, that more people are going to die, and more people are going to suffer. More families are going to lose their loved ones. More people are going to come back psychologically damaged, and it's time to bring it to an end. So that's our main emphasis. We're doing this in part because we do believe that what Cindy Sheehan started with Camp Casey down in Crawford has really touched a chord with people in this country in ways that nothing else that the peace movement has done has been able to do so far. So we are trying to find a way to take that spark and blow on it a little bit to get a little bit more heat going, to put a little bit more pressure on the administration. Something has been unleashed, and we would like that to continue growing and growing in power. If we can incite more concern about the deaths from the war and incite more political pressure on our members of Congress as well as on the administration all over the country. So it's not just Cindy Sheehan that they have to worry about, but it's Amy Antonucci and Steve Diamond and Arnie Alpert and Macy Morse and people like us all over the country. That's the type of thing that needs to happen.
And are you calling for the troops to leave Iraq now?
Yeah, the American Friends Service Committee months ago has called for the troops to be brought home now. So it's past now. It's time.
Could you say something about Iraqi casualties?
and if the exhibit takes them into account in any way?
The exhibit itself, as it's structured, primarily really does focus on the American casualties and on the boots from the U.S. soldiers. I know that we've tried in different places to try to also represent the civilian casualties in Iraq. It's maybe a little bit different of a challenge in terms of this type of symbolism, but it's certainly something that we at the AFSC understand, that this is not just a problem of American lives. Going back to the first Iraq war, it was a problem in Iraq. Going back to the years of sanctions and the hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq who died because of the sanctions, because they couldn't get medical care, because they didn't have clean water, because of what the United States was doing to their country. These are things that have also been foremost in our mind that we are really hoping that people will consider as they consider the effect of this war.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Amy.
So now we're talking to folks who are at the vigil and getting some responses and reflections from them as they stand here next to the exhibit tonight. I'm talking with Pat Morse. Pat, what do you think?
Well, Amy, I feel like this exhibit here of 10 pairs of combat boots is both appropriate and necessary. You know, our government isn't letting us see the coffins as they come home, and there's been over 2,000 of them. We really don't have any sense or feeling about the men and women who are dying, or the American men and women, I should say, who are dying there. But now this exhibit of empty boots gives us that feeling, and so, you know, it pulls at your emotions. You know, for me, it, you know, makes me look at the combat boots that I wore at one time, and, you know, makes me think about Vietnam and that sort of thing. But another thing I noticed about these boots is most of them have the name of the person who died and their rank, and naturally they're all enlisted people, no officers in the bunch, which is pretty much typical. I mean, officers do fight and die, but the vast majority of people who die in wars are young enlisted men. They're not old men, for the most part, not officers. I mean, there are exceptions to that.
It must be particularly powerful to see as a veteran.
Yeah, I had a gun in my hand at one time, and I was ready and eager to kill. I was full of rage. At that time, I considered Vietnamese to be slope-eyed gooks. They weren't human beings. And, you know, pretty much everybody that carried a gun felt the same way. You know, we had to dehumanize them in order to kill them, and it's the same way in Iraq right now. They're, you know, anything except human beings. That's how we kill them.
You've come a long way.
I don't know. I still have a lot of rage, but I deal with it every day. It comes up. We all have it in us. I mean, even the most saintly priest or nun or whatever, we all have it in us.
I'd just like to read your sign that you're holding for the vigil, since it seems to relate here, and it says, "Men don't kill."
I wrote that sign as sort of several things, a statement, a provocation, an exhortation. You know, people can take it a lot of different ways, and people have. They've responded in all different ways to the sign, and I think it works. It works for me.
Is it sort of your vision for what we could be?
Yeah, it's my vision of what we can be on a daily basis. I used to look at peace as a goal to be achieved, you know, some far off, practically unattainable goal, but it's not that far off. It's right here. It's right now. Peace is the way. It's not a goal. It's the way.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Pat.
Thank you.
And you are?
Eleanor Stewart.
And your feelings on this?
I'm very disenchanted with this war and with this president. I would like to go on record as saying I think he's the worst president we've ever had. And I can't bear the thought of this going on. You know, it never should have been started to begin with. I don't have much use for anybody in this administration.
And what do you think about the exhibit here with the boots?
I think it's very impressive. I was delighted to see people taking pictures of it.
And you are?
Sue Mayer. Well, when you see the row of boots, it really brings it home, literally. I mean, people don't think about the face of war sometimes. They just think about the policies and, you know, the larger issues. But you really have to remember that what happens to the people fighting them. Particularly bad because a lot of these young men and women didn't even have to die if they'd had proper armor. And if the vehicles they were in had been armored. And the war is bad enough as it is, but, you know, not to give the service people the equipment they need is even worse.
Thanks. My name is Judy Elliott. And what do you think about the exhibit here tonight?
Remarkably real. I mean, it really brought right back down to earth what's happening in Iraq to American soldiers anyway. It was sad to think about the soldiers whose feet would have been in those boots. There's not much more to say about it.
Thank you. Kathy, any reflections? Looking at the exhibit that's here today that isn't usually in the square.
I'm glad to see somebody personing a table that's giving more information on the draft. I believe that we were very late in getting to that during the Vietnam War, and it's good to see it happening now. American Friends Service Committee has always been in the forefront of providing that kind of information, and it's good to see a representative of that organization here today. The boots are, I understand, being used around the country to symbolize our own war dead. I think I'd like to see the number of sandals reflected there, too, for the Iraqi dead, or the sneakers, or whatever shoes they'd be wearing. Our small number of boots would be completely overwhelmed by the deaths that we have helped create in Iraq. Often when we think of the number of people dead, we tend to look at it only as Americans who've died. And indeed, that brings the message home for a lot of people, but it doesn't reflect the reality of what's been going on in Iraq for well over 10 years. We're a country that forgets quickly, and we forget that we continue to bomb that country for 10 or 11 years through three or four administrations, Democratic and Republican. So I'd like to see more shoes and fewer shoes and no shoes.
Thank you, Kathy.
Okay.
And now we go to Damon Thomas and his interview with Mary Lee Sargent from New Hampshire Peace Action about the campaign to get Senator Judd Gregg to hold a public meeting to discuss Iraq.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to the first of two interview segments here today on Making Waves. I'm Damon Thomas, and my guest this afternoon is Mary Lee Sargent of Bow, New Hampshire. Mary Lee was one of six peace activists arrested and charged with criminal trespass following the group's request for a public meeting with U.S. Senator Judd Gregg on the issue of the continued U.S. presence in Iraq. Today, you'll hear her story as we explore life and death issues and ask the difficult questions that the mainstream media continue to avoid over the continued invasion and occupation of Iraq. Mary Lee, first off, let me welcome you to Making Waves and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Damon. It's great to be here and to have an opportunity to talk about these issues.
Thanks, Mary Lee. And now for our listeners, for some background. On June 2 of this year, a group of New Hampshire residents visited Senator Gregg's New Hampshire office in Concord in their continuing effort to request a public meeting to discuss U.S. exit strategies from Iraq. And as I understand it, and perhaps you can clarify all of this background information for me, Mary Lee, that effort began back on April 12th with a letter that was hand-delivered to Senator Gregg's Washington office with hundreds of constituent signatures. And Senator Gregg apparently replied that he could not meet with the public in May. In fact, as I understand it, New Hampshire Peace Action of Concord has asserted that to date, Senator Gregg has ignored some 5 written requests for a public meeting. So on June 2nd, 14 New Hampshire residents, including yourself, brought a large exit sign and sat in Senator Gregg's office reading two lists of names, those of U.S. forces and the more than 100,000 Iraqi civilians killed since the March 2003 invasion began. The arrests then took place following the failure to secure a meeting date with the senator. First off, Mary Lee, why the call for a public meeting with Senator Gregg? What purpose would be served by holding such a meeting, and what would it consist of?
We feel that this is our senator's job to talk about the major issues that affect his constituents, and of course, the war in Iraq does affect us. I wish I had the figures right in front of me, but in our letters, we actually talk about how much it's costing the citizens of Concord, because of course we were doing our actions in Concord, how much it's cost the citizens of New Hampshire, and how much it's cost U.S. citizens to be involved in the war, both in terms of money and in terms of lives. And so we felt that an issue of this importance that affects our lives and treasure, and a moral and ethical issue, and one that more and more people are interested in and have doubts about the current U.S. policy, that it was imperative that we have a meeting. Senator Gregg, we chose in particular to focus on, as opposed to our other Senator Sununu, because Senator Gregg is chair of the Budget Committee, and we started this process in March, of course, gathering the signatures to present in that hand-delivered letter that was taken actually to Washington by our executive director, Ann Miller, of New Hampshire Peace Action. She's director of New Hampshire Peace Action, and she made a trip to D.C. to deliver this letter and all these signatures. So the process began in March, and we realized that as chair of the Budget Committee, he's one of the most important and powerful people dealing with the supplemental appropriation. And of course, that's what spurred it. Our membership, New Hampshire Peace Action's membership, had been writing as individuals to Gregg that we wanted public meetings, that we wanted him to vote against the supplemental appropriation, that we wanted an exit strategy before any more money was allocated for this occupation. And so, you know, it's been an ongoing concern that this is his job to meet with us, and there is no more important issue facing us right now than this occupation of Iraq. So to us, it was just a common sense that he represents us. And plus, there's another factor. Not only was he chair of the Budget Committee, but Senator Gregg has a history of not appearing at public meetings. And we really wanted to challenge and break that pattern and say, look, he doesn't show up at panels of the governors and ex-governors that was held at Capitol Center for the Arts. When he ran for Senate in the 90s, he wouldn't appear at public forums of the candidates that were, you know, either in the primaries or in the general election. So this is to try to get a change of behavior, in the most crucial behavior that a senator or representative or congressperson should be, you know, manifesting, and that is meeting with their constituents. So that was, we just feel that's his job. Obviously, those of us writing are longtime peace activists and concerned. Some are not longtime activists. They're just concerned about this particular war and the appropriation of, you know, I think it was $79 billion but they were asking for $87 billion. And we thought, you know, it's time to talk about what's going to happen. As you have mentioned, he did respond to this handwritten letter several weeks later, but it's just priceless because it becomes very clear, A, he can't meet with us. He's too busy. We also found out in this May, we tried to time all of our requests for when there's recess in Washington. So each request has been timed with a recess that was going to occur. A May recess, a June recess, the 4th of July recess, an August recess. So they're all timed to be very doable. And we were checking on some of the groups he's meeting with. And, of course, they're fundraisers for a Republican Party. They're with business groups and so forth. So, but he's not willing to have an open public meeting where people can ask questions about an exit strategy, to really meet with something that's not a programmed, selective group of people. So his first letter said, or his only letter, I should say, his only response was a letter that I think we got in late April in response to the April 12th letter. No, he couldn't meet with us. He was too busy in May or already scheduled. And then he gives his long explanation of why he supports the war that was very anti-Muslim, many references to Muslims as though it's a monolithic belief system, and made clear that we were bringing the free market. I mean, it was not even an attempt to put forth higher ideals. I mean, he said democracy first, but the next thing was a free market economy. And I thought, well, that's laying bare the policy. And we wanted more people than just us, you know, hearing the explanation, because we want more people to oppose the war. And a public meeting where these kinds of things are brought out and where people hear a senator say that we're over there killing people and our young men and women being killed and spending billions and billions of our money that we need for schools and just basic infrastructure and cleaning up poisons, you know, it's just unconscionable. So we feel a public meeting will be a way to expose the bankrupt policy that is based on bringing the free market and, you know, benefiting a few international corporations and maybe some workers, and that's it.
It's ironic then, in his response, if I'm hearing this correctly, that part of the reason we're over in Iraq is to promote the free market and presumably democratic ideals. Democratic ideals, it seems to me, include meeting with one's constituents, that an elected representative in government would meet with one's constituents. Here you had a situation where you've had repeated attempts to meet with the senator, New Hampshire residents, his own constituency. It's ironic that his failure to meet with you would be justified in part by his attention to details that include funding a war whose ideal is to promote democracy in another country, and yet we may not have it here.
Well, Damon, you got it right there, because this is what is really troubling, that a lot of cant and rhetoric are used, and very general cant and rhetoric about democracy and freedom are used. Meanwhile, we have the Patriot Act passing even stronger with more restrictions on people's personal freedom. So the freedom we want to bring to Iraqis, we are limiting here as fear, and unfortunately that goes along with all right-leaning governments. They use fear to concentrate power and to actually destroy democracy and basic civil rights and human rights. So yes, the irony is so clear to anyone who thinks about it for even a second. It is his job to meet with his constituents, all of them, not just the wealthy, the powerful, but with all of us who pay taxes and have concerns and are politically engaged. And so, yeah, it's just, to me, basic. And after the first letter, he has not even been polite enough to send excuses. I mean, to me, that is even worse. We have followed up with polite requests in writing. One was an open letter that we, of course, sent him, but we also sent it to the media. That was in May, early May. We sat in his office waiting for a response. One of our members for about 3 weeks sat every weekday from 4 to 5 waiting for a response. We also sat in his office reading the names of U.S. troops who had died and Iraqis who had died on May 2nd, I believe it was. We hand-delivered a request then. So, you know, we've made multiple attempts and still nothing from him, and not even an excuse. So this is, to me, something that the residents of New Hampshire need to know about our senator.
What reasons or explanations, if any, has he offered for his positions? Has he gone into specifics, or has he given you any reasons for particular failure to meet with you thus far, which is what prompted your action back on June 2nd?
Actually, no. Other than the letter I mentioned in late April giving his excuse that he was scheduled in May and could not meet during that early May recess, he's not answered anything. And the letter truly was just the same generic administration policy of we're fighting for freedom and democracy and now we're there and we can't leave or it'll be chaos. And there's this presumption in the letter. I mean, it's literally three sentences giving his rationale for supporting the policy. Democracy, I don't even think he uses freedom, that's Bush's favorite, but this free market argument, and he repeats that in the three sentences. Free market was mentioned twice. Muslims, something about them and the way they are, so this very much kind of view of the other as alien and violent. And there's also, it's unstated, but the presumption that the Iraqis, who are sophisticated people, who have had governments and who have had technologies and a society with an infrastructure, and this old kind of 19th century view of these people as savages, primitives, who need the help of a Western advanced power. Well, they were a developed nation. It's just so ignorant and with little knowledge, and that's the feeling I got from Greg's response, that he knew very little about the situation. He was making all kinds of assumptions about Muslims. We need to counteract this and combat that as one of the reasons that we're there.
It would seem that an open forum where you could have an exchange between residents of the state and the senator, that you could learn from each other, you from him and he from you. But the only way to do that would be in a face-to-face meeting where all the different views are aired. I'm not exactly sure what goes on in the halls of Congress, but it would seem, just given the type of activity that's gone on in the last 2 years in terms of the, as you mentioned, the passing of the Patriot Act, the recent strengthening of some of the more restrictive provisions of that act, and the permanent extension of some of those provisions, would suggest to me that maybe they're not receiving the full range of views that ought to be given light if it is, in fact, that we live in a democratic society. So, again, it seems that a meeting of this sort would promote the exchange of views, and he would see that there is an active concerned constituency in the state who is very concerned about the Iraq war, the effect on the people of Iraq, and the effect on folks back here in the United States. I'd like to actually turn to that for a second, because there is a great cost, it seems to me, in bringing this war to Iraq, financial cost, a human cost. I'm presuming, because you've suggested in your remarks, that this is part of the impetus for why you showed up in Senator Gregg's office. And what issues concerned you about Iraq?
First of all, it was a war that, I'm a pacifist, so it's very difficult. I mean, there's no war that I think was good and necessary, that we should talk and talk and talk, and people should talk and talk and talk until things are resolved. And in addition, we need to address the conditions that create hatred of the United States that is existing, unfortunately, not just in the Middle East, but in all parts of the world, but particularly the developing world. But, you know, there are so many issues there. A, that it was based on lies and deception, and I think that's not too strong a word. Even our representatives are beginning to use the word lies and deception and manipulation. And I think of Senator John Conyers' hearings about the Downing Street memo, where probably 40 or 50 members of the House of Representatives came and spoke, and a number of them stated clearly and unequivocally that the administration had lied, you know, not only about weapons of mass destruction, but about many other things related to that, about a threat, about a connection of Iraq to terrorism or to Al-Qaeda, all of which are false. So I think even if I were someone that was not committed to pacifism, I would be upset as a citizen that we were lied to. Iraq was no threat to the United States, and I think everybody, even the mass media who have been supine through this and done nothing to really educate the American people other than the independent media and the internet and some blogs, you know, definitely are keeping people informed that have access to those things. But, you know, even the media is admitting that Iraq was no threat, there was no connection to terrorists, and et cetera, with things that your listeners will all know. But in addition, I know that all of our wars recently, and even to a certain extent, some aspects of World War II are motivated by an American policy that has been in place since the 1890s, and it is an imperial policy. And it is to promote American corporate interests worldwide and to enhance the wealth of the few who control those corporations.
It's been suggested by more than one historian and analyst that, in fact, it's that very policy that makes us a target. President Bush has said that the terrorists, to paraphrase what he said, the terrorists hate us because we're a free society, because we love freedom. There are other Western nations, nations of the world, that certainly can be called free societies, and yet they're not targets as we are. Canada comes to mind, for instance, as do the Netherlands and Scandinavian nations. Examples of free societies that are not on anybody's hit list or targets, as we are. Doesn't it suggest that perhaps the proliferation of United States military bases and the imposition of culture and foreign policy and the outright might makes right type of invasion that we are seeing doesn't that do a little something perhaps to spur aggression or resentment and anger in other parts of the world?
Yes, I agree totally. It is our policy that is a major cause of any violence that is aimed against American interests, American people, U.S. soil itself, and those concerns are not addressed. Unfortunately, it's bipartisan, it's historic policy, and I mentioned the 1890s just because that's when the United States was clearly strong enough to be an imperial power. We've pursued the same policy since then. The historian William Appleman Williams calls it the open door world policy, which is just taking the open door policy articulated toward China, 1899-1901, and applying it to the whole world, that we don't want to establish colonies all over the world necessarily, though our military bases are colonies, and we definitely do want military bases in economically important areas of the world to keep an eye on things, to control what happens there politically. So yes, this is the cause of the terrorism, and yet that's totally being ignored. Instead, we're given these platitudes that I really don't understand how so many U.S. people who receive a decent education and know how to read and think can buy endless rhetoric that says nothing. It's not giving any explanation, no history, no understanding of why these resentments around the world exist, no discussion of our policies in Israel, no discussion of the fact that we have bases in Saudi Arabia and have since the Gulf War, that we have probably, well, I think that's the plan, to have permanent bases in Iraq, which we did not have before the war.
And if there are permanent bases in Iraq, wouldn't that suggest that the lack of an exit strategy is quite intentional?
Well, yes, indeed, it would. It's not just, oh, duh, we didn't think of that. All of this is conscious. They have intelligent people in all political points of the spectrum, and this is an intentional policy. It's a furtherance of American imperialism. You just have to study U.S. history, a 100-level course, and you see it clearly, the policy is consistent. So one of the things that we hoped in this public meeting would happen is, as you said, ideally there would be an exchange of information, because Greg is either very ignorant or he just doesn't want to deal with, you know, the realities because he is wedded to the administration policy and is one of their most fervent supporters.
Let's look at that reality. What is the cost to New Hampshire of our continued invasion and occupation of Iraq? And I pose that question because as I open the paper every day, the same newspapers that people across the Seacoast area read every day, I see of another school lunch program that's been slashed, or a school that needs to be repaired, or a school that had to be closed because of lack of funding, child care that is non-existent, environmental cleanup that doesn't get done, roadways that are in need of repair. On and on the list goes. Every day the paper documents some social need. And I look at the money that's being spent, billions of dollars to wage war in Iraq. I balance the two, and I say, coincidence? And I think not, because it seems to me that if you take money from one public sector, one sphere, and transfer to another, that there will be costs associated with the decisions you make to transfer that money and with the actual transfer, so that some are left with and some are left without the funds needed to live in a civilized and decent and humane way. Was any of this what motivated you and the group to act back in early June?
This is one of the major reasons that I am anti-war and a pacifist, that war is very costly, very capital and labor intensive and life intensive, the loss of life I'm very concerned about. But yes, I mean, New Hampshire, partly because of the unique situation of not having a good tax base. I just moved here from Illinois 2 years ago, and there's many things about New Hampshire I absolutely love. The physical environment is incomparable, but the social services compared to where I was in a university town in central Illinois are appallingly bad. There's just not money for basic infrastructure, for environmental cleanup, for education, for health care. My partner is involved in social services and social welfare work and deals with just misery of people that don't have enough to eat, don't have shelter, don't have basic necessities of life, and particularly don't have health care. So all of these things, I mean, it's totally stealing the money of the New Hampshire residents and of all the citizens of the United States. And how we can let this go on for a policy that benefits a few multinational corporations, particularly energy sector. The rest of us, 285 million or so forth, who are not at all affected by those industries, other than that we are dependent, unfortunately, on a non-renewable resource like oil. This is not a benefit to us, and it is stealing our money and using for something that enriches a very small percent of our population and harms the rest of us. And I just think back to the Vietnam War. It's been proved by historians that the Vietnam War stopped the war on poverty, you know, stopped the new society programs of Lyndon Johnson, killed them, I mean, before they could even take effect. Unfortunately, we don't have anything like that now because of the way our country has moved since the mid-70s so far to the right that there is no concern that for the civic betterment or for the community or for the good of human beings, and the idea that the government has any responsibility for our well-being is diminishing by the year. But still, what little we do have after all the cuts that the very conservative philosophy that wants to privatize everything wants us really to pay for everything. They want us to pay for schools. I mean, there are big foundations set up to try to really destroy the public schools in this country. The attempts to get rid of Social Security that was fought for 40 years before it passed. You know, so even with the little we have, they're taking that little bit and using it to kill. So there's certainly a moral cost also. I do not, in my name, want... There are 38,000 Iraqis documented. Now, the glance at the British Medical Society predicted about a year ago that there had been over 100,000, but there are 38,000 that we know their names and who they were and where they were and their ages and real people, Iraqis, that were killed. Various aid agencies have compiled this. The 100,000 plus figure is given, and I totally believe that, but that's a very general kind of prediction based on kind of statistical models, whereas these 38,000 are real human beings that we know who they were. And when you consider 1,827 U.S. service personnel since the invasion on March 19th, 2003, I mean, there's a moral cost. We're sending off young, mostly young people to kill and be killed, and they are, and thousands are being maimed. I remember in the 30s there was something called the Bonus March, where veterans of World War I marched on Washington to get their pension that they'd been promised for 1940, to get it early because many of them were unemployed. And they had these banners that I saw photographs of that said, cheered in 17, jeered in 32. And that's what will happen to our veterans. They'll be cheered and called heroes, and their pictures of the dead ones will be shown on TV. But when it comes to the services, they'll be cut, cut, cut. They'll have to fight and scrabble for every bit of disability, and yet we have thousands that have been very seriously injured and maimed. I read a book by Studs Terkel called The Good War about World War II, and there were several stories, because of course his technique is oral history, and he interviews people to tell their story, and there were several veteran stories, and I hadn't been aware of this, that had to fight for years to get 1/8 disability. They were so stingy, the government. They're very freewheeling with praise when the war is going on, but when it came to serving people who were harmed by the war, these men were fighting for years, had to hire attorneys and so forth to get 1/8 disability for service-related injuries. So there's that cost that I'm concerned about. What we are doing to a lot of people, 50% of the troops are National Guard, that A, shouldn't even be used for that purpose, and I hope that we can stop that. And they want to go to college. These are working class young people that want college, and they join, and then they're going over and being maimed and killed. This is horrifying. So, now see, I'm unfortunately not very idealistic about most politicians. I respect them because they work hard, even if I don't agree with them. I respect the work they do. I think you need to be a professional. I'm not someone that wants people off the street that are well-meaning to go run for office. But I want a whole new breed of professional politicians that care about people. And I don't care what they call themselves, that care about people, that are intelligent. And so my big thing right now is to have this public meeting so that we will influence the people at the meeting more than Greg to understand the war and to oppose the war. to also put pressure on Greg, because I don't think rational arguments affect people who are locked into their position and they have class interests and they have their philosophies and their networks. And his network is Bush and his boys. He's part of it, Judd Gregg. So it's not that he is going to learn from us anything, but he's going to be pressured by us. Public meetings expose you. They expose you to scrutiny. They expose you to the press repeating the inanities that you say that then reaches many other people. So a public meeting has a lot of purposes, and ideally it would be to have a real conversation, you know, to have a real exchange of information. But these very, very powerful people have class interests. They know what they are. They're set in pursuing them, and he is not going to listen, but he will listen in the sense of being pressured, being exposed. That's why we need him. But even more, we need to take back the Congress in 2006. Presidential politics, to me, are way down the list. We all need to get informed and vote for people who are going to be for the majority of human beings that live in this society and for their interests, and not for the interests of people that are already incredibly wealthy beyond what anyone on earth needs to be, just to make them wealthier and to have more political power, because along with this wealth comes immense power politically to buy, influence, cheat on elections. And so we need a democratic movement. You hear about these developing countries and they have a democracy movement. Well, we need a democracy movement, I'm afraid, in the United States right now. And taking back the Congress is one step.
Turning to your particular case, what's next in store for you and the other folks who were arrested in terms of the legal process?
We had our pretrial hearing, and we were held over for trial, and we will be tried October 18th, and I'm assuming that's in Concord. I'm just learning what you call your courts. Every state's three-tier court system has different names, whether they're Superior Court or District Court or Circuit Court, but it's the lowest level trial court that we'll be appearing in.
In New Hampshire, that would be the local district court, so if the arrest occurred in Concord, the case would be brought in Concord District Court. And I'm wondering, are you going to be tried together or separately?
We will be tried together. We requested that and received that, and I think the state was anxious to do that, and I think it'll make a much more powerful statement. And, of course, it'll be our chance to explain why it was so important for us to be there, because we were really waiting to hear from Greg. We had been in his office, as I mentioned earlier, sitting every day waiting. We had done 6 letters by the end of this process. We felt it was imperative that we get a response from him. So we were sitting there waiting for this response, and in the process got arrested. We want to have a chance, our day in court, to explain why it's so critical that we have this meeting, why we needed to be there in order to get this meeting for all the residents of New Hampshire.
You're listening to WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. Making Waves is the program you're listening to. I'm Damon Thomas. My guest today has been Mary Lee Sargent. We're winding up the segment of Making Waves, but I wanted to also mention to you that it seems that with some of these trials, your motivation for appearing at a particular location to protest an event or to bring attention to an issue, that seems to get shoved to the side. The whole event gets reduced to something called criminal trespass or disorderly conduct, where then the focus of the event is on you and what you may or may not have done. But this whole complex series of reasons and motivations for why you appeared there all of a sudden gets turned on you and gets reduced to a particular charge. I would hope and expect that during your day in court you'd be afforded the opportunity to present to the trier of fact, whether it's a judge or a jury, your motivations for appearing there, because it would cast the event in a totally different light.
Well, I hope this is true also, that the deeper reasons for the actions, the need for a public meeting with an elected official who has the responsibility to hear from his constituents, whether he wants to or not, that's his job. I hope all those things will come out. And of course, we're aware and enough that we need to get our message out. We don't have the vast resources. We don't own radio stations and newspapers that we depend on the mass media of communications. And so, of course, we'll have a press release that lays out very clearly what this was about, why we were there, why we're trying to hold him accountable. I hope that they're savvy enough, the media, to put that in their stories. I'm a little pessimistic just because our attorney mentioned that a lot of times the press will come to trials like this and they'll stay for 10 minutes. They're not devoting the resources or time to these issues, but hopefully the press release plus the 10 minutes, you know, will at least get them to focus somewhat on why we were there and what it is we're asking for and the reasonableness of that request.
Trials in New Hampshire are public events, so the public is certainly invited. And for any of our listeners who would want to support the six fellow residents who were arrested back on June 2nd at their trial at the Concord District Court on October 18th, that you may, in fact, wish to appear there at a court session that typically begins at 9 a.m. I would refer our listeners to New Hampshire Peace Action, which is located at 4 Park Street in Concord, New Hampshire. Their telephone number is 228-0559, and their website is www.nhpeaceaction.org. I would encourage our listeners to stay in touch with New Hampshire Peace Action for more updates with respect to the trial, or in fact to attend the trial to find out for yourself how the legal system works and how it's going to operate in this particular instance. But certainly Mary Lee and the others involved could certainly use public support. The public can certainly support meeting with Greg. You don't need to find yourself in a position where you're going to be arrested to try to certainly sway him. Certainly letters and phone calls to his office, I would imagine you would encourage from other New Hampshire residents who have feelings similar to yours. Certainly there are many things that people can do to further this action on what is a very, very critical and crucial issue facing all of us these days, which is, of course, the continued U.S. presence in Iraq and its cost ultimately to us in dollars and in human terms. Mary Lee, any final concluding thought that you'd like to leave our audience with?
Just that I want to second what you just said, that it really would be helpful if people who are questioning the war would get informed in any way you can by going to our website, going to others. There are so many other. Casualtiesofwar.org is one, and there are many more. UnitedForPeaceAndJustice.org. And get yourself informed. And also, please call, whether you have a set opinion yet about the war, to at least call Greg's office or write or email and ask for a public meeting, because that's the very least on something that's now costing, oh gosh, it's getting up into near $300 billion, 1,800 plus American troops and 37,000 documented Iraqis and probably more than 100,000 that have been killed since the invasion March 19th, 2003. So please get involved. There's also a mass march happening in Washington, D.C. In fact, a whole weekend of activities. The mass march is the 24th, but the bus is leaving the night of the 23rd, and it's leaving Portsmouth Market Square at 9 p.m. and also leaving Concord at 10 p.m. And you can call the number just given, 228-0559, to make reservations for the bus.
Thanks, Mary Lee, and I thank our listeners for listening once again to this segment of Making Waves. I'm Damon Thomas. Until next time, thank you.